This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In many ways, Americans are safer than ever. We're less likely to die in car crashes, for example, thanks to airbags and better automobile design, or perish in a fire due to buildings equipped with smoke alarms and sprinkler systems. All in all, injury prevention and consumer product safety have come a long way from a generation or two ago. But now, in the wake of another gun massacre, some in the field of public health are saying, let's apply this same approach to firearms, where you look at the data and see what it tells you about what might make the item itself safer and the user or seller or manufacturer more responsible for that safety. But there's plenty of pushback to this idea. A gun, some argue, is a tool of self-defense, a fundamental right not in any way comparable to requiring homeowners build a fence around a swimming pool. Today in The Exchange, should guns be considered part of public health policy like other consumer products that are regulated for safety, or should firearms be considered in a separate category? Let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, thoughts on this are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With us from Boston is David Hemenway. He's a professor of public health policy and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center at the Harvard School of Public Health. And David Hemenway, it's great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And joining us in studio, J.R. Hull, Republican State Representative from Dunbarton, board member of the New Hampshire Firearms Coalition. And Representative Hull, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you much.
And David, I did want to start with you for just a couple minutes here. What is a public health approach? What does that mean just in general?
Yeah, I think the big thing about the public health approach is that what we're interested in is prevention, preventing things from happening, not waiting till the very last second till something bad happens and blaming someone, but going as far upstream as possible to make it unlikely that bad things will happen. I would say if there's sort of a one phrase that exemplifies the public health approach, it's let's make it really easy to be healthy rather than difficult to be healthy. So that would be let's make it easy to eat good food rather than difficult to eat good food.
So going as far upstream to make people healthy, give us an example with a typical consumer product.
Yeah, so the example that's often used is this motor vehicle example. And so here's the story which people in public health, we tell our young over the campfire. And it's about, this is about sort of 95% correct. It's a just-so story. And it goes like this. It says, here's the way I tell it. When I was growing up, I was told that 90% of motor vehicle crashes were due to driver error, that over half of motor vehicle deaths were due to drivers deliberately misbehaving, speeding, and running red lights, and drinking and driving. And so what should we do? And the answer is, and this was the answer at the time when I was growing up, is everyone should have driver's ed, and we should really, really enforce the traffic laws. It wasn't until public health physicians began really looking at this issue, and they said, gee, can't we do something else? Instead of just looking at who caused the accident, why don't we also look at what caused the injury? And it's clear that people were being injured by steering wheels which were not collapsible and went right through their chest, by glass in the windshield, which was not safety glass, and their head would hit it and it would rip their faces apart. There was no seat belts. There was no airbags. If you lost control of the car for a second and it went off the road, you would hit trees and lampposts, which were planted right along the sides of highways. Public health physicians were saying, gee, we do not put lampposts along the sides of airport runways. Why can't we do something to make the car safer? Why can't we do something to make the road safer, the emergency medical system better, rather than focusing exclusively on the driver? And so you fast forward 60 years, and really nobody thinks the drivers are any better today than they used to be. We're better about drinking and driving, or much worse about distracted driving, texting, and so forth. But fatalities per mile driven in the United States and really throughout the developed world have fallen over 85%.
Because we've made cars safer and roadways safer.
Right. And in terms of cost effectiveness, that's much, much easier than trying to say, you know, always be good or never get depressed or always be incredibly careful, because people are people and they make mistakes and they get angry and they get suicidal.
Well, so, and I want to bring Representative Hole into this, but very, very quickly, David, what would this public health approach that you describe with the automobile, injury prevention, going as far upstream as possible, as you say, in terms of guns, what would that mean? Just
so
real
means
quick.
What you'd really want is get everyone involved and sort of step back and say, what can we do? We have a very serious problem. The first thing is you have to understand and believe that we have a very serious problem. We have such a problem compared to every other first world country. And manufacturers can help. They can make it so it's less likely to have accidents. For example, we know that a lot of kids think the gun is unloaded. They take out, they find their dad's semi-automatic, and they take out the magazine, and they think, here's the bullets, and they pull the trigger, and sometimes somebody dies. Manufacturers can do a lot of things to make it less likely that there'll be suicides or less likely that guns can get used in crimes by making guns which are more personalized. Years ago, I had my car radio stolen. The next car I bought had a sign in the windshield that said, take this, you know, you can steal the radio, but it won't work.
Because if you take it out, it's disabled.
Right. Dealers can do a whole lot more. They can use better methods about trying to reduce straw purchasing. They can worry more about selling guns to people who are suicidal. We have a lot of things dealers can do. Individuals can do a lot more. We know, you know, guns are a product which, as opposed to, say, drugs, guns are manufactured legally. They're sold legally. The first owner is typically someone who can pass a background check. And somehow guns get into clearly wrong hands.
So one of the ways
is through theft.
And we'll definitely get into a lot of the detail this whole hour. But just in general, Representative Hole, what do you think this public health approach, you know, not saying ban guns for everybody, but manufacturers could do more to make them safe. Sellers could do more to make them safe. Owners could do more to make it safe.
I think the one thing that theory doesn't address is the fact that currently there's more firearms in the U.S. than vehicles, for instance. So what we're trying to do is replace an installed base of somewhere north of 280 million, 300 million firearms that are already out there. Okay, there's only 254 million vehicles in the U.S., and for the most part, those go obsolete in a relatively short period of time.
People are always buying new cars.
Right. That's not true with firearms. So I don't think the theory of just going ahead and forcing all the manufacturers to go adopt new technology will solve the questions that the professor has alluded that would be solved.
What about the idea of sellers could be
sellers are more
involved in the safety end of this?
Sellers already have complete discretion whether they want to sell a firearm or not. They watch somebody come into their shop. The guy looks really nervous. He's sweating. He's twitchy. They start asking questions. They can deny a sale. They're fully authorized to deny a sale to anybody they want for any reason. And that's already happening when dealers are concerned about someone's health.
And we do often hear that most gun dealers, you know, you walk into Joe's shop and he's a responsible guy and he's looking out for this. What about gun shows or on the internet, Representative Hole, where at least the narrative is there's not a lot of checking there?
So those in one way are different, and they're also connected. The rules are you can't be a dealer without having someone fill out a 4473, do a background check. Okay, that is true at a gun show. That is true on the internet. That is true person to person. There is no real financial advantage to not being a dealer because you can't buy the firearms at wholesale. So you're buying everything at retail and selling at retail, and there's no markup that you can actually run a business on. And that's true at gun shows. That's also true on the internet. So what you see in those two areas, particularly maybe the internet and at the range, is current owners switching firearms amongst themselves. They tried something. They don't like the 9mm. They want to try a 45. That happens a lot. those sales are different than the ones that everybody says are in this gun show loophole, quote unquote. The gun show loophole really doesn't exist because the people who show up at the deal at the gun shows are dealers, and those dealers are obligated under federal law to make sure everybody has a background check.
Given the level of concern, Representative Hull, over, you know, most recently massacres in churches and then, you know, elementary schools, malls, what do you think would make the public safer, if not this public health approach that David's talking about?
So the FBI did a pretty thorough investigation recently into some of these mass murders, and they talk about response time. And in most cases, the response time is such that the police get there to use chalk. Unfortunately, they're there. Most of these mass crimes, mass murders, are over within a couple of minutes. The police haven't even arrived. One of the findings in the report actually says civilians should be taught how to handle these situations because you've got a much better chance of having a civilian nearby to respond in time than you do having a paid safety officer.
This is the good guy with a gun argument.
Yes, and this is the FBI's findings. And this goes through all of the mass murders for the last 15 years. The response time right now is not sufficient to address this. So if you want to figure out a better response time, there's a proactive measure that we could talk about. But under current circumstances, if a police officer gets there in 4 minutes and the murders were over in two, it doesn't do any good.
Go ahead. Did you want to say something else?
Yeah, I was going to
say,
for David. Yeah. Down in South Carolina, the laws prohibited carrying in churches unless the church actually proactively took steps to address that. So again, we have another mass murder in a gun-free zone. And that's the only place we see these. We don't see these happening in places where people are allowed to carry firearms.
David, what do you think? Does the public health approach include possible protection by the so-called good guy with a gun?
Absolutely, but there has to be really sort of good evidence. What we believe in is, trying to look at the scientific evidence. And what we find is sort of in lots of studies, what happens is a gun in the home really increases the risk for everybody in the home rather than reducing the risk. I've just done a study about self-defense gun use, and there's really no evidence that self-defense gun use, promotes safety. You can be your chance of being injured when you use a gun is no less than when you use sort of any other method to try to protect yourself on average. One of the things I would really sort of emphasize is that the United States has this enormous, enormous problem. And again, you have to recognize that there is a problem before you're willing to do anything. And one of the big problem is when you look at every other developed country, and it's two dozen other developed countries, they don't have this problem. And it's not like they're nicer people than we are. It's not like they have less non-gun crime than we have. It's not like they are, less anything, less likely to be bullies than we are. What they have is they're less likely to have easy access to everybody for guns.
Okay, and David, I'm going to cut you off there for a quick second. We'll be back after a break. Representative Hull, I know you need to head down to the State House. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Republican State Representative J.R. Hull from Dunbarton. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the idea of whether gun violence could be considered a public health issue and treated as such. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call. What do you think? Should guns be considered part of public health policy, injury prevention, like other consumer products that are regulated for safety, whether it's cars or sprinkler systems for homes or requiring homeowners to build a fence around a swimming pool? Do you think that makes sense or not? Should firearms be considered in a different category? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joining us from Boston is David Hemenway. He's a professor of public health policy, director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center at the Harvard School of Public Health. And joining us now in the studio is Susan Olson. She is legislative director for the Women's Defense League of New Hampshire. And Susan, welcome to The Exchange. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, and you were listening to our earlier conversation about just looking at guns as a public health issue, wondering if we can reduce gun violence by using this approach. I just wonder broadly what you think.
Well, good morning, Professor. He posited that we need to go as far up the chain as possible.
As far upstream as possible, yeah.
And that does beg a couple of questions, one of which is when you look at perhaps people who have been involved in some of these horrific crimes, there are a number of common denominators there, one of which I think we have found on most of them, and of course, Professor, I would defer to you because I don't have your skill set, is a common use of psychotropic narcotics, whether they're for depression, whether they're for bipolar disorders, whether they are they don't typically seem to be drug addicts like heroin addicts who are out trying to use firearms to rob people to continue their habits. So the idea that perhaps some of these young men, and most of them seem to be young men, have either from being given Ritalin in grade school to whatever it is that they're using now, I think that that's a very interesting field of study because it does seem to be part of that Venn diagram.
You know, I was thinking about that, Susan, before the show, and I did want to ask you too, David Hemenway. In most of these shootings, there does seem to be some issue of instability. The killer seems extremely angry, lashing out, mentally unstable, call it what you will. Their state of mind is dangerous. Is this also part of the public health approach, the state of mind of the killer instead of the weapon he chooses?
I think the answer is yes. I mean, public health is interested in all different ways to try to reduce the problem. And we're happy, for example, in motor vehicle to try to figure out ways to make the driver better and less likely to text and so forth and so on. But one of the big things to recognize is that guns are also an enormous part of the problem because we know that other developed countries don't have this problem. They have people who take these drugs. They have people who get angry, but they don't have this problem. So as an analogy, kids in Boston, we asked kids not only in Boston but adolescents throughout inner cities, and we say, is it easy to get a gun? And they say yes. And then we say, have you ever carried a gun? And too many have. And then a question we ask is, what kind of world would you like it to live in, where it's easy for teens like you to get a gun, where it's difficult, or where it's impossible? And the large majority, the overwhelming majority of kids say, we'd like to live in a world where it's impossible for teens like us to get guns. The majority of kids who have illegally carried guns want to live in a world where it's impossible for teens like them to get guns. Adults in every other developed country have created a society where it's very difficult for 17-year-olds to get guns, and we haven't. And so not surprisingly, we have this enormous problem in inner cities that other countries don't have. In the same way, we have this enormous problem with mass shootings, and they've figured out a way to reduce the mass shootings and to reduce the killings. And it's, yes, you want to look at the kids. Yes, you want to do lots of things, but one of the things that just jumps out is we have to do something about guns.
Well, and just real quickly, I did want to address this with you, David, because you've said it twice that other countries don't have this problem. President Obama said something similar after this last massacre. And then PolitiFact looked at it. And in fact, you've probably seen these numbers, David.
Yeah, they actually
we've got a problem, but we're not the only ones that have this problem.
It's the same way we're not the only problem with gun, other people have gun problems. But if you look at our frequency, not the number of people killed, because the number of people killed, one person in Norway kills 65 people, and then they're off the chart.
And we're a huge country.
But if you look at the number of, we're sort of tied with one other little country that had two mass shootings in the last, 12 years or 15 years, whatever it was. But otherwise, we're, number one. If you compare us to any other country, we're number one. And we're certainly number one. We just looked at the data in the United States versus all the other first world countries for 2010. Our gun homicide rate is not 20% higher, 50%. It's 25 times higher, the average of these other countries. Our gun suicide rate is 8 times higher. Our unintentional gun death rate is 6 times higher. If you look at 5 to 14-year-olds, a child in the United States is 18 times more likely to be murdered than children in other countries. And it's not just our minorities. You can look at just, you know, compare our whites to everybody in other developed countries. And our whites have so much higher rates of likelihood of being murdered with a gun, committing suicide with a gun, unintentionally being killed with a gun.
Okay. And I didn't intend to go down the international comparison route, but I did just want to raise that. And I did want to let folks know that we'll put the PolitiFact number crunching of this issue on our website, and we'll set it aside for now. But it seems like you're saying, David, that this issue that Susan raises, that let's, if we're going to look at this in a public health way, let's also look at the mental state of the shooter. That needs to be part of the discussion.
All different answers. We could look at, you know, the parenting of the shooter. We could look at lots of things. And there's no question that's what we want to do. We want to look at all aspects of it.
All right.
But to deny that we should look at the gun aspect of it is crazy.
Well, and we asked our Facebook followers, is gun violence a public health issue? Got a couple of responses. Nancy says, yes, it should be treated as such. Steve says it's a people issue. And John says, no, it's not. It's the mental health or lack of parenting that's the issue in so many of these events. Susan, do you want to jump in real quick? And then we've got lots of people who want to also chime in into our conversation.
Well, I'll be very interested to hear what folks have to say. I would ask the professor one question. He talks about inner cities. He talks about perhaps even the disparity between races. He talks about young people. And I took the liberty of doing a little homework on some of the work that he and others have done on this. And I find it very troubling that a lot of the premises upon which some of these studies have been undertaken draws this very clear, to me, pejorative line between, quote, the general population, end quote, blacks. And it seems to align with black populations all sorts of really horrible assumptions, whether it's family conflict, acculturation into white societies. Because it says here in this one report from 2013, which is looking at the public health aspect, general population risk factors, prior suicide attempts, alcohol and drug abuse, mood and anxiety disorders, access to a means to lethal means. And then it says blacks, in addition to all the others, have these other problems. Oh, my goodness. Marital status, family conflict, acculturation, hopelessness, mental health service access, religion, emotional and social support, strong sense of heritage. I wonder, does he see this as a racial issue? Or are we not all to be treated equally? Here in New Hampshire, we're having that discussion right now, and it's quite disturbing.
Well, it's a discussion certainly going on nationally. And since you directly asked, David, about the numbers, David, I'll give you a chance to jump in there, and then I do want to go to our listeners and hear what they have to say about this idea of gun safety, treating gun violence as a public health issue or not. But go ahead, David, real quickly on the racial disparities there. It's definitely a topic at play.
I almost never write at all. I don't know what she's not quoting from my work, but I almost never actually write about racial disparities. Lots of other people do for good reason. But what we know is that, for example, in the United States, we have a big problem we have in terms of guns is gun suicide. And there it's much more of a white problem than an African-American or minority problem. And that's the problem that New Hampshire has. And what we know is that within the United States, areas, you know, households with guns are much more likely to end up with somebody dying in a suicide. We know across states what it really explains different rates of suicide is not mental health, and it's not suicide ideation. It's not even suicide attempts. It's simply, do you have easy access to incredibly lethal means of killing yourself, which is guns? And so that's the big problem New Hampshire has. New Hampshire has many more gun deaths per capita than Massachusetts, even though Massachusetts, we have more urbanization and more crime. But because so many people use guns, and that's the problem in New Hampshire. And the second big problem I think New Hampshire has is that they let their guns be brought into Massachusetts and sold to people who clearly should not have them. So the guns which our criminals use in Massachusetts, particularly in Boston, come from New Hampshire and Vermont.
Let's go to our listeners. Again, on this idea of taking some of the lessons we've learned from public health and injury prevention, whether they're applicable to guns or not, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Thanks for those Facebook comments that I read a minute ago. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. And both of you, let's go to Aaron in Newmarket. Go ahead, Aaron. You're in the Exchange. Welcome. Aaron, good morning. Are you with us? Okay. Aaron, I hope you call back. It'd be good to hear from you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Rob who says, I have heard that in Switzerland, nearly everyone owns a gun and have been given safety training and even marksman training. They have among the lowest crime and murder rates in the world. Rob says maybe everyone here should have a gun and the training to know how to use it safely. Love to hear from both of you on this. Susan, you first. You know, if someone goes and buys a gun, do they have to take a training course first? Do they have to be certified that they know how to use it and how not to use it?
Well, you know, it's. I'm glad you asked that question because that sort of lets me do a little shameless self promotion in the Women's Defense League of New Hampshire. We have two goals. First is the education and training of women with firearms, whether it's to become a target shooter, whether it's for self-defense, or whether it's because they find it to be an interesting hobby. The second, of course, is the legislative advocacy. You will find, oddly enough perhaps, that with women being the largest and fastest growing segment of firearm ownership in the United States, that the first thing women tend to do after they've purchased a firearm, or even before they've purchased a firearm, is seek training.
Is it required that they seek training?
No.
Do you need to take to – so you well, could buy a gun and not be trained how to use it?
Yes, if you meet the criteria in the state of New Hampshire and under federal law before you can purchase one from a federally firearms licensed dealer, an FFL. In most states, for example, if you choose – and Massachusetts is one of them. If someone in Massachusetts wishes to carry a firearm, they must provide evidence of a training course. And there are many training courses that meet those requirements. I'm an NRA pistol instructor, in fact, and one of the classes that we teach provides that sort of advocacy.
But it's not required.
In New Hampshire. It isn't. It isn't. You know, Massachusetts is a strange place, so I would not ever assume to know what goes on in Massachusetts. But
well, let's talk about New Hampshire then.
In New Hampshire, no, it is not required.
And do you think it should be, given that we have heard stories about people who, you know, have a gun and they get a little nervous and they shoot and they make a terrible mistake? What do you think about that?
I don't know how many of those stories there actually are versus what they are on the rumor mill. Most – I won't say most because I don't have that firsthand knowledge. But like anything, whether it's a drill press or any sort of piece of equipment, most people seek to understand how they operate before they employ them. I didn't read the instruction manual on my stove just because I had a general understanding of how it works. But, you know, I looked at – tried to figure out how you turn it to self-clean. I read those instructions. Generally, people like to know, but it would not be my decision to force someone.
Why not, given that a gun could kill someone? Why shouldn't they have training?
A brick could kill someone. A baseball bat could kill someone. Drawing out the distinction between, quote, weapons, a keen wit is a weapon. So do I have to give instructions on that? I think that this is, unfortunately, forgive me, Professor, a straw man argument.
Although a brick isn't designed to kill. It's designed for building walls or houses or something.
Well, I don't know about that. Some people might use them as a brick bat. But there's this automatic pejorative presumption that firearms are only designed to kill. I've had firearms in my house for 40 years, and maybe they're just lazy, but they've never killed anybody.
Well, Rob, thank you for the email. You can email us as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Both of you to our callers. And let's go to Kevin next. He's
in
Bedford.
Can I make a comment quickly?
Yes. Yes. Go ahead, David, and then I want to get Kevin in.
Yeah. One is quickly about Switzerland. And you should realize about Switzerland is that they have fewer private guns per capita than we have. They have much stronger gun laws than we have about those guns, that the public guns which they own, that they don't ever, that they're not for self-defense, that if they, you know, they have to store those guns if they have them in their house at all really properly, and if they even open the bag of ammunition, the ammunition, they can get court-martialed. So it's very different kinds of guns that we're talking about. But in terms of training, I think if you're going to have a gun, you should be trained. But I also think, and we've been looking at what trainers actually do, that some of the training should be about the dangers of guns. Trainers should have to talk about suicide, gun suicide. For every accidental gun death, there's 30 gun suicides, and gun trainers don't typically talk about that. And I think people should be trained, if they're going to have a gun, about how to resolve conflict amicably, how to reduce the level of conflict, rather than being trained about how to use their gun if things get heated.
Well, and Kevin in Bedford, I do want to go to you. Go ahead, Kevin. You're on the line. We're heading into a break, but go ahead, Kevin.
I'll be quick.
Laura. Sure.
Love your program. Is this a public health issue? I don't think so. I'm with that woman saying it might be a straw man. Criminals get guns. Criminals get meth. Both of them are illegal. Okay. The shooting in South Carolina was an illegal gun. The Sandy Hook guy killed his mother for the gun. Illegal. We need to do a mental health thing. And then if you go to parenting... Anyway,
well,
we're going to debate this.
Yeah.
We waste a lot of time and money when we could be helping the mentally impaired.
And I'm going to let you go, but similar to what one of our Facebook commenters made, we'll follow up in just a minute. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're asking this question. Should gun violence be considered a public health issue? And if so, what would that mean? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Susan Olson's in studio, legislative director for the Women's Defense League of New Hampshire. On the phone, David Hemenway, professor of public health and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center at the Harvard School of Public Health. And David, real quick, our caller, Kevin, just before the break, making the point that someone else made earlier, that let's not focus on the gun, but the mental state of the criminal, the shooter, and that should be the public health element, if any. Go ahead, David. I'd love to hear from you again on that.
One, this is clearly a public health issue where we have, on a typical day in the United States, over 300 people are shot and over 90 die, and there's maybe 1,000 criminal gun uses of guns, and people are afraid, and on and on and on. And then secondly, it's that, you know, we're back as we were in motor vehicles. You know, let's just worry about the driver as we were 60 years ago. And the answer is yes, you worry about the driver, but we have to worry about other things as well. We want to worry about mental health. We want to worry about poverty. We want to worry about parenting. But to say we should not worry about the gun just seems to me ludicrous.
So look at the whole picture.
Especially when we know that every other developed country has worried about the gun as opposed to these other areas, and they do so much better than we do.
Well, lots of commentary again from our listeners. Kevin, thank you for that call. Here's an email from Barbara. I was furious listening to our Congress pontificate about the auto deaths caused by ignition switches while they blatantly ignored all gun deaths. The discrepancy, Barbara says, is incredible. Deb says, yes, this is not just a public health issue. Deb says, is it a public health crisis? If a virus were killing more than 30,000 people a year, we would be spending millions of dollars to solve the problem. Thank you for those emails. Let's go back to our callers. And Steve's joining us from Portsmouth. Go ahead, Steve. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
You know, Pete, it's my understanding, and maybe you can correct me, but I remember a few years ago that the CDC wanted to fund a public health study of gun violence, and the Republicans blocked it, that they would allow no money. They would not even allow the issue to be studied. And I think it gets back to what the gentleman said earlier, that when you start, instead of looking at the drivers, you start looking at all the things that surround the drivers, then you can start having an effect on improving the situation. And my second point is just, you know, that whole good guy with the gun. I read studies of the police and military people who have been trained to be under fire, and they go through severe psychological changes when they're experiencing being shot at. And to expect some civilian with a gun to all of a sudden intervene in a live fire circumstance, I think is crazy.
Well, Steve, thank you for calling. So 2 points there real quick. To you first, David, he said that researchers like yourself have been partly blocked from studying this issue further. Is that your experience?
That's correct. It's been very difficult to get money from the feds. It hasn't been entirely blocked. It's made incredibly difficult. The CDC for the last 20 years has been afraid to say the word guns in public forums.
Okay, to you, Susan, the good guy with a gun argument. We talked about this earlier, but boy, there's a lot of back and forth and data on this, whether we're safer or not safer when more citizens are armed.
Excuse me. There's actually a case not too long ago of a woman who was a member of a church congregation who was also a volunteer security officer there, who in fact stopped what could have been a horrible massacre. She almost lost her own life. But
now, she was well-trained, though, right, if she's a security officer?
I'm not necessarily. Part of using any tool, part of driving a motorcycle, part of driving a car, part of doing anything is skill and the acquisition of skill. And certainly, I would think that she had not just training, because the Department of Motor Vehicles in New Hampshire will give me a motorcycle license after I've been in a closed parking lot for several hours on a 125cc motorcycle. So that says, that license says I'm qualified to ride that motorcycle. It's up to the individual person then to acquire those skill sets to not only make their own use of that motorcycle pleasurable, but to make it safer. So that young woman was trained, had a skill set. One presumes that she worked on her skill set to keep it fresh. And for that reason, plus having courage and faith and determination and a willingness to lay down her life for someone else, she saved an awful lot of people.
The motorcycle analogy, and this gets back to, we keep getting back to automobiles, but if you wanted to ride a motorcycle, though, you would have to take a training course to prove that you could get a license for, you have to get a motorcycle license and that you can operate it safely. Obviously, there's skill that's involved, right? You have to keep riding, and every time you ride, presumably you get better. But you told us earlier that with a gun, you don't need to take a training course.
I'm not guaranteed a motorcycle under either the New Hampshire or the U.S. Constitution.
So fundamental constitutional right. That's the difference, you're saying.
Well, it's also the natural right of self-defense, which is one of the things that we talk about at the Women's Defense League. We believe women should be able to defend themselves.
Let's take another call. This is Alice in Grantham. Hi, Alice. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a public health professional, and I'm struggling a little bit to understand how we could not consider the issue of gun violence a public health issue. The public health approach is a way that we understand problems. It doesn't necessarily presuppose what the solution to that problem is going to be. And I think the professor and the comment made about CDC's inability to really research the problem is is where this lies. If we take a public health approach to this, we're going to have an open process of understanding public health violence, looking at the agent, meaning the gun, looking at the host, meaning the people that use those guns to inflict violence, looking at the environment, the culture, the laws, the regulations, and try to understand where the weak points are. Public health professionals might then put together a list of potential approaches for reducing gun violence, but that's not the political process. The political process enters when it comes to selecting what our society is willing to do. I think where I'm concerned is if we aren't given, as public health professionals, the opportunity to truly understand and research what the problem is and to present all of that information to the public, then the public doesn't have the opportunity to really see it. You know, one case study here or there, there's always going to be an example of something wonderful that happened because a civilian had a gun, but public health looks at the big picture.
Okay, Alice, thank you. Yeah, so not making policy by anecdote here and anecdote there. Let's go to another caller. This is Seth in Concord. Hi, Seth. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi, Laura. You know, often the statistics, I think, are measuring the wrong things. Often we hear things like, you know, the U.S. has more murders with guns, or more guns means that people are more likely to be assaulted with a gun. But that's not what we're trying to prevent here, I don't think. We're trying to prevent robbery and murder, period, not robbery and murder with guns. So we can look at other countries and what they've done, and we see that, for instance, Australia basically had a broad-based ban of guns in 1997, and they saw an increase in murder reaching an all-time high in 2006. Their assaults per 100,000 are now higher than they were before the ban, and most other violent crimes are either unchanged or higher. Now, the question we need to ask is, why is that? And I think the answer is pretty simple. Guns save lives. There are over 2.5 million defensive uses of guns per year, and a defensive use might not include pulling the trigger. It might also be simply saying, I have a gun, or showing a gun. And this will often end what would have been a very violent encounter. And this professor, you know, I think when we're talking about gun control, sometimes we're only talking about half of it. You know, well, can we prevent this side of the problem? But I think that we also need to talk about, if we're making guns harder to get, we're also going to have more robbery victims, more rape victims who weren't able to defend themselves. And that's also a problem. And sometimes it is the bigger problem, that more making access to guns more difficult actually raises violent crime for that reason.
So, Seth, more guns or people being armed would make us safer?
The statistics have shown that in this country compared to other countries, that when we have more guns, I'm not saying that the United States does not have a violent crime problem that's different than other countries, but I am saying that when you hold everything else equal, and you have fewer guns in the equation, violent crime goes up.
Okay. Now, Seth, I'm going to let you go just in the interest of time, and I do appreciate your call. David and Susan, we keep getting back to this. Statistics, good guy with a gun, does that help? Does that not help? Here's a question for you, and I'll throw this to you first, David. In 2000, an ABC Washington Post poll found 51% of Americans believed having a gun in the house made it a more dangerous place, while only 35% believed it made a house safer. In a more recent poll, opinions were reversed. 53% said having a gun made the house safer. 35% said it made the home more dangerous. What does the public health data say about this, David? And then what do these numbers suggest to you about how people interpret the role of guns in our society in making us safer or not?
Yeah, so there have been lots of studies, and I sort of disagree entirely with the caller about what the studies show. We just did a study looking at across the United States, and in areas where there's more guns, there's neither more or less non-gun crime, but there's lots more gun crime. Guns don't seem to be a deterrent at all. We've looked at a lot at self-defense gun use, and we just have a paper out about from the National Crime Victimization Survey, and there they had over 300 attempted rapes. And even though a third of guns of households have guns in the United States, zero times was a woman able to get a gun to protect herself against the rape. A previous study looked at the National Crime Victimization Survey at over 1,000 rapes, and only one time was a woman able to get a gun to prevent the sexual assault. So I don't really see, even though we have lots of guns and pretty weak gun laws, we're still not doing very good, particularly protecting women with guns, by the use of guns.
What about the perception, though? The public
I would
perception?
Argue, yeah, the perception is sort of scary. We we've been doing surveys of gun researchers, and the overwhelming majority of gun researchers who have looked at the data think a gun in a home makes it much, much more dangerous. But people have wrong opinions about lots of things. Every year they ask people, do you think crime has increased? And they always say yes. And for the last 25 years, crime has been decreasing in the United States and throughout the world, the developed world anyway. So, yeah, people's it would be nice if there was more money for research and more money for dissemination and people got more accurate information.
Okay. Go ahead real quick on that as well, Susan, please.
Well, more money always seems to be requested to solve problems, and I don't see that those problems have been solved regardless. But what I would like to say in New Hampshire, and we've been studying this for over a year, initially started by a piece of legislation that was introduced last year that sought to legally stigmatize the mentally ill. That bill was defeated.
I remember that. That was a Senate bill that said people who had some history of mental illness could not own a gun.
Absolutely. And again, it seems to try to classify people and stigmatize them by virtue of whatever their particular area is. But when you go back to New Hampshire's firearm laws, and this is what's so troubling to me, and nobody wants to talk about this, is when the New Hampshire firearms law was passed that set out the requirement to have a license to, in the beginning, own a firearm, much less carry a firearm loaded outside of one's home, it was the direct result of two things, a nine-month strike at the Amiskeg Mills and a concern locally in Manchester that some of these foreign-born, unnaturalized persons, these people needed to be protected from these mass hordes of foreigners.
That was the prevailing thinking at the time.
That was the prevailing thinking. And interestingly enough, that's still on the books because the legislature, the general court in 1923 said that, well, you know what, maybe you can own a firearm if you're not a foreign-born, unnaturalized person, if local law enforcement decides that you're a suitable person. Well, you know what? There's no definition of suitable anywhere in statute. And today, for someone, a woman, for example, who's frightened of a potential domestic assault, either by an ex-husband or an angry boyfriend, she's legally allowed to own a firearm in her house to protect herself and her children from a potential attack. However, if she wanted to leave the house and take those children to school or go to work or pick up a prescription, she would have to wait up to 14 days for her local chief of police to decide whether she's a suitable person. Now, we're happy to have the firearms discussion any time, but make no mistake, Professor, and make no mistake, anyone else, the firearms laws in New Hampshire are wholly based on discrimination and racism against ethnic minorities, against genders, and it needs to stop. Governor hasn't had a chance to change that now, but the laws in New Hampshire are based wholly on discrimination and someone being suitable in the eyes of whomever's making that decision. That's just wrong. There's no defense for that, Professor.
Well, and I don't think that, in fairness, Professor Hemingway, Susan, is saying that we should discriminate against people. But just to close out with you, David Hemingway, again, you've been putting forward this public health argument. Where do you think it's going to go from here?
Well, in public health has been incredibly successful in so many different areas where people said, whenever the strongest lobby in the United States was the smoking lobby, was the tobacco lobby, and still things got changed. And I see things changing here. One of the things I really want to see changed is not laws, but social norms. I would really like to see a social norm change so that it really was immoral. People understood that it was immoral to sell a gun to a complete stranger without a background check.
All right. We will leave it at that. David Hemenway, thank you very much for giving us an hour of your time. We really appreciate it.
Sure.
That's David Hemenway. He's director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. And Susan Olson, it was good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Susan Olson, she's legislative director for the Women's Defense League of New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Faith Mikesell and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.